What's up, everybody? My name is Dimitri Kafinas, and you're listening to Hidden Forces, a podcast that inspires investors, entrepreneurs, and everyday citizens to challenge consensus narratives and to learn how to think critically about the systems of power shaping our world. My guest on this episode, which was originally made available to premium subscribers only, is economist and author Charles Goodhart. Professor Goodhart is widely recognized for his contributions to the fields of monetary economics and central bank policy, and he is perhaps most famously associated with what we commonly refer to as Goodhart's Law, the stipulation that any observed statistical regularity ceases to function as an objective or accurate measure the moment that it becomes a target of public policy. Both Professor Goodhart and his co-author and former colleague Manoj Pradhan recently co-authored a book which puts forward a compelling and controversial argument about the long-term effects of an aging society on inflation, interest rates, investment, savings, and consumption, as well as economic growth and public policy decisions related to things like taxes and government spending, all of which we discuss in today's conversation. The main argument put forward by both authors is that the inevitable decline in dependency ratios caused by aging demographics will lead to structural, long-term increases in interest rates and inflation that will strain government finances and jeopardize the policy-making independence of central banks as their mandates to control inflation come increasingly into conflict with the objectives of politicians and national governments. Now, you could argue that we are already seeing the early evidence in support of these conclusions. And so my objective in bringing Professor Goodhart onto the podcast today was to more fully explore the arguments and assumptions that he and his co-author make in the book, the evidence in support of their conclusions, and the implications of their findings and projections for the economy, investors, and governments. For anyone new to the program, Hidden Forces is listener-supported. I don't rely on advertisers or commercial sponsors, which is why the second hour of our conversations is normally available to premium subscribers only. If you want access to our full episode library, as well as the transcripts and intelligence reports, which include my takeaways from every episode and my thoughts on what comes next, head over to hiddenforces.io, select the episode that you're interested in, and click on the premium extras, where you can then sign up to one of our premium content tiers. And with that, please enjoy this extremely informative conversation with my guest, Charles Goodhart. Dr. Charles Goodhart, welcome to Hidden Forces.
I'm glad to be here.
It's my pleasure having you on here, Professor. So, as I will have mentioned in the introduction, you've written a very interesting book. The book is titled The Great Demographic Reversal, Aging Societies, Waning Inequality, and an Inflation Revival. Most of the book, as I understand it, was written in 2019, and it was published in 2020. And many of the predictions that you make in the book, related to inflation in particular, have in fact manifested. We're living through them currently. To what extent they'll prove durable is debatable, and it's certainly something that I want to explore with you here today. But before we do that, I'd love to know what the origins of this book are, and when you and your co-author began to develop the arguments that you put forward in it.
As I recall, and my memory is getting worse, the problem that we were concerned with was why there was such disinflation in the period after the great financial crisis in 2008, and why the recovery was so sluggish. I was working at that time as a consultant at Morgan Stanley in London, and Manoj Pradhan was another economist working at Morgan Stanley. And we began developing the thesis that the underlying reason for the disinflation that was occurring at that time and the reason why central banks were unable to effectively counter it was because there was a huge surge in the availability of labor. And we wrote a quite long article, which was presented at a Bank for International Settlements meeting in, I think it was 2018, it might have been 2017, I can't remember the exact date.
It's actually 2017, if you're referring to demographics will reverse.
That's right.
Three multi-decade global trends.
That's right. And it was really an extension of that paper into a much longer and more detailed format that led to the book. In particular, the great argument against our view that a shortage of labor and an increase in the proportion in the population of the aged, of the retired aged, would be inflationary, was to argue that, well, surely Japan has had a reduction in its labor force earlier, an increase in the aged working in Japan, and it doesn't that provide an important, indeed, convincing argument against your general thesis? So we actually had to study and work out arguments about why inflation remained so low in Japan before we could really do the rest of the book. And we have a whole chapter devoted to what had happened in Japan. It is chapter 9, Why Didn't It Happen in Japan? A Revisionist History of Japanese Evolution.
Yeah, so I very much actually want to ask you that as part of a larger conversation around counter arguments to your thesis. But before we even get into that, I really want to delve into the book's main conclusions. And also, if you can tell us what you feel the big story of the last 30 years is. So is essentially that, how would you describe the role of labor and labor oversupply and its impact on inflation and its impact on debt and interest rates, et cetera, and equality versus inequality? What is that impact over the last 30 or 40 years? Where do you begin the time series? And why do you feel that all of this is in the process of reversing?
Okay. The basic argument that we make is that the mainstream economists in general have not appreciated how extraordinary were the developments in the provision and availability of labor that occurred in the 30 years between about 1990 and 2020. There were effectively three elements in this. The first element is the purely demographic element. There had been a baby boom in the decade or so immediately after World War II, and this was now working its way through the labor force, so that there was an increase in the number of workers from the earlier baby boom. Secondly, after the post-World War II baby boom, the proportion or the number of children that on average each woman gave birth to began to decline very sharply, so that the birth rate in most developed countries fell from about 4 or 5 per woman to the level that it now is, which is significantly under the rate that would maintain the population constant, which is 2.1 children per woman, because a few die in the early ages. And it has now actually, in many of our countries, gone below 1.5. So the population eventually will actually decline. But in the years between 1990 to 2020, it meant that the number of children that women had declined really very sharply. Moreover, the increase in the availability of consumer durables, refrigerators, freezers, washing machines, etc., meant that women no longer had to shop every day and undertake household activities every day, with the result that when I was young, the proportion of women actually participating in the workforce was probably no more than about 10 or 15%. By the time we get to the period from 1990 to 2020, it had risen very sharply, over 60%. Now, in addition to the fact that there were more people of working age, and that many more were now participating in the workforce because of the availability of women to work in the workforce rather than do housework. It was also the case that the expectation of life was rising, but was rising rather slower, so that what is known as the dependency ratio, the ratio of workers to those who were dependent upon the workers, the young and the old, the dependency ratio improved very sharply. Now, there's a very simple sort of a way of looking at this, which is that the more workers you have relative to dependents, the more disinflationary the situation will be, because you don't hire somebody to work for you unless you expect the value of their output to be greater than the wage you pay them, obviously. And moreover, they've got to save for their retirement. So workers, or an increase in the proportion of workers, is generally disinflationary, whereas dependents, the young and the old, are inflationary because they consume but don't produce. And in fact, an increasing share of the old, which we're going to have increasingly over the next few decades, is even more inflationary because they require a lot of assistance, because frequently they become incapacitated and need, besides getting pensions, they need medicine. And when they're incapacitated, they need a lot of care. So the demographic conditions were very, very favorable during these years. Moreover, there was a huge increase in globalization, as after the fall of the Iron Curtain, Eastern Europe became part of the world's trading system, as did China after Deng Xiaoping. And that meant that the availability of workers, because China is the most populous country in the world, to anyone who could move their production to a low wage from a high wage economy, was going to do very well. And there was an enormous amount of such offshoring. Such offshoring was largely in the form of manufacturing, which meant that all our economies moved from being quite largely having manufactured production to a much more service economy. And it's much easier to put pressure on employers for labor bargaining power to be stronger and for trade unions to operate when workers are gathered together in large numbers in factories rather than in small groups in services. And that meant that the power of labor effectively became broken, and the strength of private sector trade unions declined really very sharply between 1990 and really up to 2020. With the power of the trade unions and labor bargaining power broken, and with the ability of employers to shift production to low-wage economies and gain high profits from doing so, the benefits of the growth of output during these 30 years shifted increasingly towards capital, whether in the form of human capital, particular skills, or financial capital or real capital, and away from labor. This is much more evident in the United States than it is in Europe, but there has happened to a degree in Europe as well. And that meant that inequality within countries increased. It was probably the best 30 years in which to be a capitalist in the modern world ever, but the benefits did not go in any way so much towards labor. Now, the two factors have occurred recently. First, the dependency ratio is beginning to rise adversely with the decline in the working age population in many of our countries and its slower growth virtually everywhere, and the increasing share of the old in our economies who are expensive, fiscally expensive. They consume quite a lot, but they do not produce. And also, of course, the division of the world into geopolitical blocks again, and the tendency to feel that you need to make your supply chain safe by having it based in friendly countries rather than in the least cost countries, so that the spat or conflict between the US and China is having the effect, and will have the effect, of reducing the forces that have brought declining goods prices and disinflation to much of the Western world, alongside the fact that China and indeed Russia are two of the countries where the workforce is going to decline really quite sharply from now on.
How significant has the role of technology been in putting downward pressure on prices during this period? How would you rank that effect?
Certainly it's been an effect, but one of the great concerns over the last decade or so has been that productivity has been very slow. And as you probably know, Robert Gordon has written a book arguing that technological advances will be much harder to attain over the next decades than they were earlier, because all the, if you like, the low-hanging fruit have already been picked. Now, that's not generally accepted, but I would argue that there is another factor as well, which is that the ability to move particularly manufacturing production offshore to low-wage economies so maintained the profitability of the companies doing so that they really didn't need to invest domestically in order to maintain a satisfactory, indeed quite fast rate, profit growth. In our view, one of the beneficial effects of the changing demographic and geopolitical conditions is that the upwards pressure on wages that we see from a growth of labor tightness, shortage of labor, will force companies to have to invest domestically in order to keep unit labor costs down and to maintain their profitability. So we actually see the rate of growth of output per worker improving over coming decades. And moreover, we are concerned that an increasing share of the workforce will have to be channeled into looking after the old when they become incapacitated. It's something like 20% of the Japanese workforce. And consequently, rather than fear the introduction of technology and robots and AI and all the rest of it, we think that actually we're going to need all the technological improvements we can get in order to offset the adverse effects on overall aggregate growth from the fact that the labor force is going to be increasingly on the downward slope over future decades.
So you mentioned that one of the factors driving the disinflation over the last 30 years has been the decrease in the dependency ratio, and that in the next 20, 30 years that we're going to be living through, that one of the dominant forces that's going to be driving inflation is going to be the reversal of that. The fact that we have more and more people that are entering into the period of their life where they're going to be less productive, but going to be simultaneously consuming resources.
Yeah.
One of the questions I have about that is the assumption that they're going to be able to maintain a certain level of consumption. We do know that in general, over people's lifetimes today, even now, with all the entitlement programs that exist, older people consume less. So do your assumptions take that into account? In other words, is the idea that the consumption patterns that we see today for people that are above 65, that are above 75, will be relatively similar, and that the major assumption that you're making that others don't is that those entitlement programs that sustain that consumption are going to remain in place? Is that essentially it?
To a degree, yes. And if you look at the figures for the life cycle development of incomes and consumption as people age, you will in fact see that the young actually consume a great deal less than those of working age, but the old actually consume rather more. Now, the reason why the old consume rather more is not because we go on more holidays or we buy more clothes or we buy fancier food. The reason why the old consume more is that they need more care and they need more medicine. And that drives their consumption up. So when you say the old consume less, you're thinking of sort of standard goods and services rather than thinking as well of the need for people to look after the old. And it's very difficult to do that by robots.
Well, let me ask you, if you don't mind, I want to actually interject and ask a question here. First of all, I want to make sure I understand what national cohort we're looking at here and if there's a difference between how much older people consume in the United States, where, let's say, drug prices are excessively high, versus in India, for example, where you have multi-generational households, a lot of the support for aging members of society are provided by younger people. How are you taking those factors into account?
Well, I'm assuming, if you like, a more advanced world. Remember, people with fewer children, it's going to be hard for them to provide support. And let me take China, for example. And in the old days, the old were looked after within the family group. Nowadays, if you've got the one-child policy, which, remember, was introduced, I can't remember the exact date, but certainly by the 1970s, you've got one grandchild with four grandparents. Moreover, the one grandchild may have migrated from the agricultural peasant West to the manufacturing East of China. So there's absolutely no way that in China you can expect that the old will get looked after within the family circle. And again, the same is true, admittedly, to a somewhat lesser extent in the West. The idea that we're going to get looked after, in Victorian times, the old were looked after by the unmarried daughters. And the idea that that might be true nowadays, would be regarded, I think, with a certain degree of amazement in our current societies. The old either get along on their own, or if they are incapacitated and severely incapacitated, they have to go into various specialist old people's homes. And that latter costs a great deal of money.
So there's so many different parts of this argument that I want to dig into. Since you brought up China, China has a very interesting demographic curve because of the one-child policy. So there's going to be a period in time in the near future where the stress caused by the fact that the dependency ratios blow out is going to be greater, I guess, than, is it fair to say, than any other country? Is that accurate?
As great as any other country. I wouldn't say necessarily greater.
Okay.
It's going to be quite severe in Russia, quite severe in Germany, much less severe in the US and the UK, but partly because of immigration. If there was no immigration, our working age population would also be going down. But in fact, it's just going to grow more slowly over the next decade or so.
So what role does excess capacity here play? Because in the world that we're describing over the coming decades, it isn't just that dependency ratios change, but also the expectation would be that overall populations will decline, correct?
Won't decline for about the next 15 years, as I remember my demographic data.
Okay.
Because the reason they won't decline is because, apart from the COVID years, we're otherwise almost all living a lot longer. But the section of the population which is growing proportionately the fastest is the very old. And so that what we're getting is a slower growing population with a very rapid rise in the number of those over 65, and particularly the number of those over 85, offsetting a very slow growing or even declining working age population, and again, a very slow growing or even declining population of young below the age of 20.
So you said this earlier, that older people consume, I don't know if you said it, but it was implied that they consume different types of things than younger people do.
Yes.
So younger people consume more homes, they consume more durable goods, cars, etc. Is there going to be variability? And older people consume services in the form of healthcare. Is there going to be a discrepancy in your estimation in terms of where we're going to see inflation? In other words, are we going to see deflation of the cost of automobiles, refrigerators, et cetera, but inflation and the cost of certain services, so like healthcare services are going to cost more for the elderly, but maybe new car prices are going to decline. I mean, how do we, or do you see it as just a general increase in inflation across the board?
Well, again, one of the things that the book emphasizes is that with the growth of the world economy, you've got to look at this in terms of the world as a whole rather than individual countries. So we think that what is going to happen is that goods prices, well, I think that you're right that service prices will rise more than goods prices, because that's what the old or increasing proportion of the population largely need to consume. But of course, it will lead to, particularly alongside the geopolitical problems, the decline in goods prices, which have been a major element over the last three decades, will end. And we already have a sharp differentiation between goods prices, which until very recently have been generally declining, and service prices, which have been generally rising. And that differential is likely to become at least as marked, if not more marked, in the future.
So what you are saying is there is going to be variability in terms of where we're going to see the inflation.
Oh, yeah. There always has been, and there always will be.
So let's investigate another assumption that you make in the book, which is that governments will continue to honor the pensions, the healthcare insurance policies, et cetera, that they currently provide to their aging citizens. This is obviously going to put a huge strain on working people who also have a say in how their society is governed and in the choices that their government makes. Make the argument for me as to why we can continue to expect to see that as opposed to governments just cutting back on these unfunded liabilities, like in the US, like Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security.
They may have to cut back somewhat because the old, of whom I'm now one, have had, I think, a very fortunate life. And as you indicate, the condition in terms of taxation of workers in future may be increasingly harsh. But one of the issues here is a sort of political science issue, which is that the proportion of the old who vote be a good deal higher than the proportion of the young who vote. And the suggestion that the retirement age should be raised, or that you should cut back on the relative generosity of pensions or Medicare and Medicaid, tends to run into very severe political opposition. To take one example, Putin, who after all is an autocrat with great control over Russian conditions, the one area where he tried to bring about what he thought of as the appropriate reform, which was to raise the retirement age, met with such opposition that he was forced to some extent to back down. Again, until very, very recently, although the expectation of life was steadily increasing, the age of retirement was held either constant or actually reduced. It has only been, I think, in the last sort of maybe 5 or 10 years that there has been any tendency whatsoever for politicians to try to raise the retirement age. And it is so unpopular as a generality with the voting public that the only way to do this is usually to say that you will raise the retirement age not now, but say 20 years in advance. So the main argument we make is, if you like, a political one, that we don't think it would be possible for politicians to do this. There's also, I think, a more moral welfare type argument, which is how far is it actually right to reduce the relative benefits of Medicare and Medicaid to our populations?
Yeah, I mean, I thought about this a bit because you raised it in the book. And one further point of support for your argument is actually the response of governments across the world, and particularly in China, for reasons perhaps that are multifaceted. The very stringent COVID measures that were put in place. Now, COVID disproportionately impacted and threatened older demographics. And yet, societies across both the West and East made every effort to try and to lower the incidence of mortality and morbidity as a result of the spread of the virus in order to contain it. So I think that's an interesting piece of support, which is, in other words, that broadly speaking, what we do see is that governments have and do put policies into effect that may actually be detrimental to younger people in order to support the interests of older folks. Now, I also, when I was thinking through that, I also thought to myself, well, it's also true that older people, baby boomers, we're talking about now, pretty much control the government. It's certainly the case in the US and in Europe. I don't know what other parts of the world look like, but certainly here. At some point, those individuals pass away, and the people in positions of power begin to reflect the demographics of, let's say, millennials or Gen Xers. So how much of that is a role? Not the fact that older people have voting power, because also I wonder to what degree older folks will remain active voters. I don't know, because one of the things that you also bring up in the book is that the incidence of dementia and illnesses like this are on the rise. I don't know how many people with dementia vote. So the point I'm trying to make, or the question I'm trying to formulate here, is how much of this is actually a result of the fact that the people in power are of the same age as the demographics that we're talking about here. And as the demographics of the people in power change, you can expect the demographics of the people that they serve to also change. And maybe we're extrapolating current trends into the future when we shouldn't necessarily.
That may be so, but let me put a counter argument, which is that you tend to come into power when you are in your 50s and 60s, because it's difficult to climb the greasy ladder until that time. So that those in power will always tend to be relatively close to retirement, and they will have, therefore, the interests of the retired at heart, whereas they may think that the young are in better shape to look after themselves.
Yeah, I guess that wasn't, though, true in the post-World War II period. Is that simply because we had the biggest demographic? Well, no, because we also had, that was the people that were running the country at the time were veterans of World War II. I don't know. Anyway, it was just a thought that I had. Let's talk about, so we in the future that you're putting forward here, we're going to see rises in inflation. Let's talk about where the money comes from to support the consumption of a portion of the population which is unable to basically pay its own way because they're not gainfully employed or they're not as productive. What role does debt play in this situation? How much of this comes from borrowing? How much of this would come from monetization of debt? How much would come from taxes? How do you see that happening? And what happens to interest rates in this environment?
That's a very important question. If you look at your Congressional Budget Office studies of the longer term future for fiscal developments, you will see that the COVID bulge in debt was simply a little small blip in what is, in their view and mine, a continuing upwards trend, which gets more and more vertical, in the debt ratio, largely as a result of the expenses of Medicare and Medicaid and so on over time. And the same is exactly true for the UK. If you look at the Office for Budget Responsibility, the OBR, and you look at their long-term projections, you will see that under present policies, with existing taxes and existing policies on retirement ages, Medicare, Medicaid, etc., that the debt ratio effectively explodes. And that will be made a lot worse if nominal interest rates start rising quite sharply.
Which is obviously what's happened in the very recent past.
Indeed. Now, the implication of that, according, for example, to John Cochrane of Stanford University, is that the underlying situation is inevitably going to be increasingly inflationary because the ministers of finance, the Secretary of the Treasury, simply cannot afford to pay out these large sums and will have to therefore finance their expenditures through monetary expansion. The alternative that we are faced with is either to cut back really quite severely on the benefits to the old, which we've talked about already, or to impose much higher taxes. But taxes are also highly politically unpopular. And the question is, how are we going to get through this? And how are we going to square the fiscal equations so that we don't have an explosive debt ratio? We don't have a situation where we are forced to monetize the debt and therefore tend to get into increasing inflation. How are we actually going to do it? What is going to happen to the taxes and or to expenditures of various kinds, including defense expenditures, which are likely to rise? Basically, we are now in a very difficult fiscal situation. Expenditures, because of the worsening dependency ratio and the increasing population of the old, public sector expenditures are going to go up. And we don't have enough taxes to meet that. And the debt ratio and the debt service burden are simply going to expand without limit until something blows. And that will be extremely unattractive. And that raises the question of what on earth are we going to do? Are we going to raise much more additional taxation? How are the existing workers going to react if they are taxed more? What other taxes can we consider? Or are we going to cut back somehow on the public sector benefits to the elderly?
So what happens to economic growth in this environment? And actually, two questions. One, what happens to economic growth? And also, just an observation, I'd like for you to comment on it. How important does political power become for voting blocks of people in this type of a world? Because it seems like so much of what determines standard of living for the individuals discussed here is how much they're taxed and the benefits that they receive from the state.
Well, let's take that in two parts. The first thing is that output is done by those who work. And the decline in the growth of the working age population means that overall output is almost certain to grow less fast than it has been growing in the last three decades. That doesn't mean to say that output per worker will grow less fast. Output per worker is probably likely to grow faster, but overall growth will decline. And that will certainly be a problem, particularly in some ways for China, I think, because they're going to have to shift from having really very fast growth of about sort of 6 to 8% per annum down to something that may be lucky to be 2 or 3% per annum. And that is coming down the road at them really quite quickly. And for the Western countries, it's going to be a reduction from growth of maybe 2% per annum to growth of maybe sort of 0.5% to 1% per annum overall. And that's going to be a problem. Your second part of your question was about voting blocs. There are many, many different reasons why people join differing parties, and that may alter in future. But certainly, the younger part of our population, the workers, are going to resent the higher taxation, which seems likely to be coming down the road at them.
I also wonder how they're going to react to that, right? So besides simply demanding higher wages, which would increase inflation. By the way, that's actually an interesting point now that I'm thinking aloud, which is that inflation is the government's friend when it comes to paying out liabilities. So if the government has to cut Social Security checks, depending on what it decides to index the inflation of those checks to, inflation can be its friend. Does the inflation actually help offset some of the pressure on government expenditures to the aging cohort in this scenario?
To a limited extent, yes. But if the inflation is expected, then everyone will try and adjust their position so they're in real terms, they remain the same. The inflation has got to be greater than people expect, as it is now. The inflation now is much greater than people expect. Even so, it doesn't automatically benefit the public sector for two reasons. The first one is that quite a lot of the debt is now index linked, in other words, linked to the rate of inflation. And that means, to that extent, that doesn't help. The second is that insofar as wages are indexed, again, it doesn't help the government because the inflation then just becomes even greater. Back in 1973, in the UK, the then Prime Minister, Ted Heath, agreed that trades union wages, particularly public sector trades union wages, should be indexed to prices. And when the Israel-Arab War came and oil prices shot up by a factor of four, that indexation of wages in the UK meant we suffered much more from inflation than any other country in the world because they didn't have indexed wages. So, to the degree that as you get more inflation, people insist on protecting themselves through some form of indexation, the more difficult the overall situation becomes because the less the benefit to the public sector and the worse the overall inflationary conditions and the worse the debt service ratio becomes.
So, Professor, my last question or questions for you have to do with what investors not should do, but how investors should think about the sectors or industries or types of companies that would perform better in this type of environment. And one of the things that comes to mind here is housing, because again, one of your conclusions in the book also is somewhat counterintuitive, which is that you think that housing will actually do well. And the reason for that, as I understood it, is because you expect that we will not see an increase in multi-generational housing in the United States and Europe. And I would love to understand a little bit more about that because I feel like what we have, in fact, been seeing is more people living at home with their parents. And one of the trends that I have intuitively expected to see more of is people living with their parents and helping their parents basically manage retirement into the end of life and inheriting their homes so that much of that would happen. Where is your thesis different on this?
You may be right on that one. I wouldn't want to go to the great lengths to try and disagree with you. I think our argument was rather that old people don't like moving because it's very stressful. They've mostly paid off their mortgage, so they don't have to. And as the children eventually leave home, what you will get will be a misallocation of floor space, with the old staying on, rattling around in a larger house than they need because they don't want to face the reality of selling up and maybe going to an old people's home. And that therefore the children, as and when they leave, have to buy houses of their own because there's an overall misallocation of floor space. Now, if the children, of course, stay at home, then that your counter argument would hold. But at the moment, of course, housing prices have increased drastically because of the very low interest rates that we've had over the last couple of decades. And it's very difficult for the young to buy houses. In the short run, I expect nominal interest rates to go up to a point where the housing markets and our economies crack. And we get a fairly sharp decline in housing prices. But I was thinking much more of the medium and longer term future, whereby, with housing prices having been brought sharply down from the present very exalted levels, that the misallocation of floor space because of the old wanting to stay on in their big houses will lead to a greater demand for housing overall than simply looking at demographic figures might otherwise suggest. But as you say, if the young stay on at home, then that won't happen. But it's a question of whether the young will stay on at home. One point in your favor of your argument is that the age of having the first child, and very frequently the only child, has now risen very sharply. So that when I was young in the 1940s and early 1950s, the age of having a first child was in the low 20s. Now the average age of having the first child has moved up in many countries to the low 30s. And that means that children will tend to be staying with their parents until the parents are considerably older than was the case many decades ago. So I see the merits of your argument, and perhaps we should have qualified the argument about housing.
So my last question is, what does this mean for the types of financial returns that we can expect to see in the coming decades, and what types of assets or investments might under or overperform based on what we've seen over the last 30 years?
The last 30 years have been wonderful for people holding financial assets. Interest rates have trended downwards, which has meant that if you hold government bonds, they've appreciated over time. Housing prices have rocketed up in relationship to average incomes. Equities have done extraordinarily well. As I said earlier, if you held capital, the returns to capital over these last 30 years up to 2020 have been really dramatic, much greater than the return to labor. And it's basically the thesis of our book that the returns to capital will come down and come down quite sharply overall. There are also always going to be sectors that are down, do quite well. And pharmaceuticals, for example, the older need more pills than the young. So pharmaceuticals will do well. People investing in old people's homes will do quite well. And of course, there may be certain parts of the world which will do better than others. One of the key issues is that the massive decline in the birth rate that we've seen over most of the world is not true, particularly in Africa. In Africa, the birth rate per women is still in the sort of 4 to 5, or even in some countries, higher range. And their population is exploding. Their working age population is exploding. The population of Nigeria within about 10 years is going to be bigger than the population of the United States. And one of the questions that is very much, I think, open is whether Africa can become the China of the next few decades. Very uncertain, because China had the advantage of maybe an authoritarian, but nevertheless an efficient administration. It was unified, and it had a pretty well-educated workforce. There's a long way to go before the political administration in Africa can have the same ability as in China. And Africa is divided up into many countries, I think something like 45 countries. So it's not unified in the way that China was. And the educational level of the African workforce is lower than the education level of the Chinese workforce. But one of the major questions of the longer term future is going to be how Africa develops and how we can help Africa to develop.
So actually, one last question for you, Professor. It's not related to Africa or, you know, whether or not the labor in African countries can be as productive as Western labor without actually emigrating here, and whether actually some of the more populist anti-immigrant sentiments will actually allow for that to happen. That would be an interesting conversation to have as well. But my actual last question for you is about the yield curve, because I believe in the book you say that the long-term consequences of what you're describing would lead to a steepening of the curve, but that's actually not what we have been seeing. I mean, how do you see that? What accounts for why we're seeing the short end rise relative to the long end? And is that something that you expect to change in short order?
Yes, and the development of quantitative tightening, the opposite of quantitative easing, or QE as it's normally known, could well bring that about. In the short run, the short rates are rising very sharply because of the need to bring inflation back towards target, though I doubt whether they will succeed in doing that in any short order. The long rate is held down because people's expectations are generally adaptive, in the sense that you expect for the future what you have observed in the past. And what people have observed in the past have been 3 decades of declining and then very low inflation. Most people now working in banks and in investment banks have known nothing other than low and declining inflation. And therefore, particularly with central banks saying that they will bring it back to target, inflation back to target, and with many mainstream economists claiming that the longer-term future is still going to be secular stagnation and lower for longer, that their expectations of the longer-term future is that we're going to revert to very low inflation. And our book takes the opposite line. And therefore, it's no surprise with central banks, most economists, and their own experience leading them to expect that things will go back to what they're used to seeing in the past, that longer-term expectations about inflation, it will return to the low levels of the past, and with that, longer-term interest, nominal interest rates, will also return to the lower levels of the past. But the longer the present inflation lasts, the more that these expectations will, even for the long term, will slowly ratchet up. And if you add the ratcheting up of expectations to the fact that fiscal and other conditions are worsening quite sharply and quantitative tightening is taking place, that long-term interest rates will rise. And when eventually the recession that I think is going to occur takes place, what will then happen will be that short rates will fall back, and fall back quite sharply relative to long rates. So that the steepening of the yield curve is something that I think that Manoj and I would expect to see in, say, something like about 5 to 10 years. It's not happening now, certainly, rather the opposite, but we think that it will happen.
Because presumably we're going to go through a period of very, very low growth as a result of a prolonged recession where inflation is also going to come down temporarily.
Yes.
That's essentially your thesis. So, Professor Goodhart, this is wonderful. Thank you so much. I got so much value out of reading your book. I think, like I said at the very top, it's valuable just the fact that it puts forward a thesis and an argument that is so different, that runs so counter to the consensus about the effects of aging demographics on inflation. Just that alone makes it worth reading, but it's very detailed. There's a lot of data that you put forward in the book, and I just found it incredibly useful, and I recommend it to anyone who's interested in the subject. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast to talk about it.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
For more information about this week's episode, or if you want easy access to related programming, visit our website at hiddenforces.io and subscribe to our free email list. If you want access to full episodes, transcripts, and intelligence reports, which include additional notes, resources, links, and other material that will help you get the most out of each and every episode, check out our premium subscription, available through the Hidden Forces website at hiddenforces.io/subscribe. Today's episode was produced by me and edited by Stylianos Nikolaou. For more episodes, you can check out our website at hiddenforces.io. Join the conversation on Twitter at hiddenforcespod, or send me an email at info@hiddenforces.io. As always, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.